Violist Carol Rodlin had a great job at the New England Conservatory. But when there was an opening in the viola department at the Eastman School of Music, she jumped at the chance. What does it take to move a studio from Beantown to the Flower City? We'll find out on today's Backstage Pass. I'm Julia Figueres. This broadcast of Backstage Pass is made possible in part by a grant from the Gouvernet Arts Fund at Rochester Area Community Foundation, encouraging support of the arts. We've got the new viola sheriff in town next on WXXI. This is Backstage Pass. I'm Julia Figueres, and today we have one of the newest musical members of the Rochester community in our studios. We have the new viola professor at the Eastman School of Music, Carol Rodlin. Welcome, Carol.
Hello. Glad to be here.
It's great to have you here. And your duo partner today is Marc Antonio Barone, who came all the way from Philly. Thank you.
I'm delighted to have done so.
Well, let's talk a little bit about why in the world one would move from Boston to Rochester.
Well, Eastman actually has a special place in the hearts of my family members. I'm the rogue in my family. Everyone else is an organist, and I'm the big rebel. I'm a violist. But my sister and brother-in-law both went to Eastman, got their doctorates here, and my mother does her sabbaticals here. My father was also an organist, my grandmother too, and Eastman's been known for a long time as the organ school. I also know and cherish many of my colleagues here from various summer festivals. And so when Charlie Castleman sent me an email last September asking me if I might be interested in looking at this position, I didn't think about it very long. I said yes right away, and then George Taylor called me immediately, and then the ball went rolling on from there.
Your family didn't cast you out when you announced that you weren't going to be an organist?
No, they actually wanted me to be a doctor or a lawyer and make some money in the family, but that didn't work either.
You filled John Graham's chair, and that's a pretty big opening to fill.
I don't think you could ever fill John Graham's shoes, but I make my own shoes, and I hope to bring something new and fresh to Eastman that's perhaps different from anything that's been done before. I come from a background we call this the Tuttle School. Karen Tuttle was my teacher, and she has spawned many people who believe in her philosophies, and each of us does it differently. But my special brand has the Rodlin stamp on it somehow.
You brought members of your studio with you. Is that common?
Yes, I think because Eastman and New England Conservatory are both very high-level schools, and there's much traffic between those institutions anyway. And I think, you know, many times, most of the time, a student at this level comes to apply with a certain teacher, applies to a school to work with a certain teacher. And so as I have one of my students who traveled with me here turning pages today, and Kyle was in the middle of his studies at NEC, and it wasn't really a good time to stop. So I was very glad that he decided to come along. And actually, timing-wise, this was perfect if we were going to make a change like this, because half of my studio graduated last year. And I have five who are in the final year of their program now who I go back and forth to Boston to teach this year. And then everyone else who actually applied for my class at NEC, Eastman very kindly accepted sight unseen, and they came along. So we have a good cross-section here.
You also travel between schools, Tony, to do teaching as well.
Yes, I teach both at the Bryn Mawr Conservatory of Music, which is a private music school that my father founded in 1934 in Bryn Mawr, Pennsylvania.
Oh, well, then you were in trouble if you didn't do this.
You're darn right. I grew up in that building, and it permeated my very being with music. And I also teach at Swarthmore College, which is just down the road.
So is there, I will ask each of you, a distinct difference in teaching and expectations in each of your schools between the New England Conservatory and the Eastman? Do you have different expectations for you?
No, I'm just as hard on people here as I was there, I think.
Well, the nature of the two schools where I teach is very different. The Bryn Mawr Conservatory is not an accredited institution. It's not an academic institution. It's a kind of school where people come to study music privately. And I have students there, not at the moment, but my youngest has been 5 years old in the past. He's now 11. And I'm working with a gentleman who's 89. and all ages in between. And of course, at Swarthmore College, I'm dealing with students of a particular age. Some of my younger students in Bryn Mawr probably will go on to careers in music, and the expectations at Swarthmore are not necessarily in that direction, because a lot of students at Swarthmore who are very gifted musicians are actually in, you know, pre-med or other sciences or humanities programs, and music may or may not be the focus of their lives later on. But the standard remains the same everywhere, you know, even with the youngest beginner. I want to hear a final product with each piece that is worthy of being heard by the most sensitive ears.
You actually have the setup in Swarthmore is quite different from the setup in most schools for a specific reason.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, we don't have a performance faculty at Swarthmore. As I say, it's a liberal arts school, and the music department is really an academically oriented department. The studies are primarily in the areas of theory and history. But the department firmly believes that people who play instruments or sing are going to get further with their academic studies and understand why they're studying the history and the theory better if they pursue the study in performance as well. So I'm a member of the faculty because I teach the keyboard skills section of the theory courses there, but my piano teaching is equally important to me. So I'm one of the few who actually teach on the premises. Students who win subsidies for their private lessons can apply them with any teacher anywhere. So we have students who go into Philadelphia to study with members of the Philadelphia Orchestra. We have students who travel to New York for their lessons. And the great thing from my point of view is that that means that anybody who's studying with me is doing so because he or she wants to, not because I'm the only teacher in town.
I want to talk to both of you about your students, and I want to talk to you both about, you can stand up because we're going to get some playing done here in a second, Carol. I want to talk to you both about your students, what you see in your students, and about competitions when we return, but it's Backstage Pass, which means we're about to be listening to a little bit of music. A broadcast of WXXI's Backstage Pass is made possible in part by Glatley Pianoforte in Canandaigua, who provided the Kauai Piano to WXXI for this program and other local arts productions. Glatley Pianoforte provides sales, service, and renovation for stage and studio. GlatleyPiano.com. Here is Carol Rodlin and Tony Barone as they perform the first and fourth movements of Brahms' Sonata in F minor on WXXI. Thank you. The first and fourth movements of Brahms' Sonata in F Minor, Opus 120, on Backstage Pass with our violist Carol Rodlin and pianist Tony Barone. Broadcast of WXXI's Backstage Pass is made possible in part by a grant from the Gouvernet Arts Fund at Rochester Area Community Foundation, encouraging support of the arts. I mentioned I wanted to talk to you both about competitions and your students, because we have in the room, I am pretty honored to be sitting near a Leeds and Busoni competition winner. Very impressive, Tony.
Thank you.
And Carol, you've won a few of your own, and you're involved in competitions as well, including the Primrose International Viola Competition. So, having said that, do you prep your students for competitions?
Well, you know what Bartok said about competitions. Competitions are for horses, not for people. And I have to agree with him somewhat, because music is not something that you can objectively judge with a quantifiable result. That being said, I do know from my own experience on one side of the jury table as the performer, and now on the other side of the jury table as the adjudicator, and also as the teacher of students who are going into these, it makes your focus in your work go up to a much higher level, because a competition often requires a specific repertoire list. It's often larger than the amount of pieces you would keep on the stove simultaneously. And I know that it, as a, if you look at it as something that helps you improve, then I think it's a wonderful thing. If you go in there thinking you're an absolute useless wreck of a person if you don't win, then it's damaging. So it has everything to do with attitude, I think, and going into it knowing that you want to work on yourself, because you can't, you know, having sat with very respectable, wonderful people on the jury, people I really do respect, we have such different opinions of what really strikes us as phenomenal. Now, the cream does rise to the top level of player almost always gets to the last round. But then the question of what you choose is a very difficult one. And I hope that all the students know that if they play well, that's the important thing. They cannot determine the result because everybody's tastes are different. And if they really made a musical statement worth talking about, they might have offended someone, and that's a good thing.
I want to go back to that in a second. Tony, I want to get your viewpoint as somebody who's won two very major competitions, what that was like for you, and the value, ultimately, of a competition for you.
Well, I take a very pragmatic view of this. The value is very simply the prize that you get, the concerts that you get as a result. There really, in my opinion, isn't a tremendous artistic or human benefit from entering competitions. So with my own students, I don't particularly stress this as a means of self-improvement. It's a means to a career end sometimes, and that has its own kind of validity. But I would shy strongly away from trying to tailor one's playing to what one thinks is going to succeed in a competition. As Carol says, that's totally useless because you never know what an individual panel of judges are going to be listening for. And it's ultimately very destructive to a person if you do that. My take from having sat on juries is that a juror in a competition has to be exactly the opposite of a teacher. When I teach, I view it as my responsibility to point out everything that a student is doing that I disagree with, and to voice my disagreement strongly so that we can have good arguments about it, learn each other's viewpoints, and come to some kind of a meeting of the minds that is ultimately going to best represent the student's musical abilities and personality. A juror must refrain from voicing his differences of opinion. A juror's judge's duty, is to recognize talent. And sometimes a very talented person can play in a way that you completely disagree with, and unless you think that that difference of style is actually injurious to the music being played, you've got to put your opinions aside.
Carol?
Well, that's a bit of a gray area, actually, because when you get... I just came off of judging the Primrose International Viola Competition, and we heard 70 people in 2 days, and we were supposed to narrow that 70 down to 8. We managed to get it down to 17. and then we had to go from 17 to 3, and we managed to get that down to 6. And this was because there were so many people who played at that objectively high level that it became very difficult because then your personal opinion does come into it. But what I was very proud of us in that competition because we made a pact not to discuss amongst ourselves any of the candidates in any of the rounds. We did not voice our opinions with one another. We did it by numbers. We tried to be as fair as we could. And as I said, the cream rose to the top, and then it became very, very difficult to decide which cream to choose for which part of the prize package, you know? But it was actually, I was so inspired to hear so much wonderful playing from the young people last June.
Well, we're very inspired to hear a lot of wonderful playing in our room. And you get to take a break now, Tony.
Yes.
Because you are about to play solo. Our guest today is Carol Rodlin. And she is going to be playing for us a piece from a composer who has graced our airwaves from time to time, formerly at the Eastman School of Music, Augusta Reed Thomas. As we listen to a work for solo viola called Incantation on WXXI. Incantation for Solo Viola by Augusta Reed Thomas. Our violist today on Backstage Pass is Carol Rodlin, new at the Eastman School of Music. That piece, very evocative piece, feels a lot like the Chaconne by Bach in many ways.
Yes, I love Augusta Reed Thomas's music. Her gestures are so direct and honest and deeply felt, and she never wastes any words, which I really treasure. She actually wrote this piece for Catherine Tate, the wonderful violin professor here at Eastman, and Catherine had this premiere, and I'm so sorry that I didn't know her, because I sense her spirit through this music as something much larger than life, and I'm very grateful that Gusty was willing and able to transcribe this piece as well as another partner piece that I often play called Pulsar for solo viola. And these two pieces actually had their premieres in the viola versions at my festival at New England Conservatory called Sound Encounters, which is a new music festival. And we were so fortunate to have as our first composer in residence Augusta Reed Thomas. And she worked with the faculty members, but the students also had the opportunity to coach with her, which was just phenomenal for them.
You are both very grounded in strong proponents in music of our day. You're about to do a lot of Elliot Carter, Tony.
Yes, I'm participating in a 100th birthday tribute to him, which is actually part of a larger tribute to one of his teachers, Nadia Boulanger, by Orchestra 2001 in November.
Now, let's talk a little bit about the program that you brought with us, because you kind of have partner pieces here today. We began with the Brahms, and we're going to be moving into a piece fairly shortly by George Rochberg, which I understand are really kind of related to one another.
Well, when I called George Rochberg to ask if he would listen to Carol and me play his viola sonata in what turned out to be the last year of his life, he said, sure, you can come over, you can play for me, I'll be very happy to hear it, but I can tell you a few things over the phone that will get you started in the right direction. And he said, you should think of this piece as very late Brahms, you know, the kind of music he wrote after he died.
And so we like to group these sonatas together as a sort of homage to George.
Indeed.
What was George Rochberg like?
Well, I only met him on that one day, but it is a day I will never forget. How old was he, 87?
I think, approximately.
And he had more energy than I think I've ever had. And he's so passionate and articulate and very, very clear about what he likes and doesn't like, which I greatly appreciate. Nothing unclear about that wonderful lesson we had together.
So he told you if you were doing it wrong.
Yes, unfortunately, he loved us. So it was, and I've heard that if that's not the case, it could have been rough.
Yeah. Well, he was very outspoken. And throughout his life as a performer and as a teacher and as a writer, he constantly generated a certain amount of controversy. A big example of that was when, after about 10 years of writing 12-tone music, in the mid-60s, after the death of his son Paul, he decided to return to writing tonal music, sometimes what people considered very blatantly tonal music, with large quotations from music of the past.
Which was almost punished by jail time in that period.
Yeah, people were horrified. And I think a lot of people thought that he relished that controversy, and I don't think that's so. He was a very sensitive man. And the controversy actually cost him a lot emotionally.
I remember very clearly, actually, one of the comments he made to me about this sonata and about that period in his life after his son died. He felt that he could not express what he was feeling in that other realm. He was forced back by his grief into some kind of tonality. And I was deeply moved by that.
In Alex Ross's book, The Rest is Noise, he discusses this tonality and the intellectualism that was behind the 12-tone system. Why would one like that? I mean, I go to a movie, a concert hall, to be moved, to be touched, to cry, maybe to laugh, not to be intellectual.
Well, I think you have to understand that although the 12-tone system or the serial system of composition, of course, requires a certain intellectual rigor. So does a tonal system of composition. You can write any kind of music you choose, really, within the limits of the system that you're using. And one thing that I found really remarkable about Rochberg is that at no point did he disavow his own 12-tone music. He strongly believed in it. And he wrote, I'm paraphrasing here, but he wrote that whether he was writing tonally, atonally, or serially, his prime concern was to make beautiful melodies.
Well, I think we'd like to hear some beautiful melodies now here on WXXI. Now, having talked about the Rockberg, let us listen to it. Carol Rodlin, the violist, the new violist at the Eastman School of Music, and Tony Barone will be performing the second movement of George Rockberg's Sonata for Violin and Piano on Backstage Pass. I'm sorry, Viola and Piano. Oh, she's going to get me for that.
Thank you.
The second movement of George Rochberg's Sonata for Viola and Piano on Backstage Pass. Production of Backstage Pass is made possible in part by Glatley Pianoforte in Canandaigua, who provided the Kauai Piano to WXXI for this program and other local arts productions. Glatley Pianoforte provides sales, service, and renovation for stage and studio, glatleypiano.com. With us today, our violist is Carol Rodland, and at the piano is Tony Barone. All right, I made the slip. I admit it. The violin-viola slip. So the first thing I have to ask you is, did you start, Carol, on violin like so many violists do?
I did indeed. I was 4 years old, and I was a Suzuki kid. And then when I was... I blame this on two people, I want to say. When I would practice the violin above the third position, my dog would start howling. And so I credit her with getting me in love with the lower tones. And also, I had the privilege of playing the viola for fun in about the sixth grade in my Suzuki teacher's... It was one of those end-of-the-year concerts, and she wanted me to help out the little kids, so she let me play on her viola, and I really loved the sound so much. And I still love her viola, and I would be so curious to know how I would feel about its sound now. But anyway, when I was in seventh grade, I started doing a lot of both, and then in eighth grade, I entered the pre-college division at the Juilliard School, and they gave me a nice scholarship if I would be a violist. And so I really decided, since I liked it better anyway, I kind of never looked back. I did both for a while because I didn't want to be one of those violists who played the viola because she couldn't play the violin. So I made myself learn some of the standard concertos and got them to a point where it was respectable and decided, well, I don't really need to do that because I don't like it that much and I love the viola. So that was that.
I hear there's a lot of scholarship money still for violists and bassoonists. There's kind of a shortage there.
Actually, people keep saying that, but where I am just coming from at New England Conservatory, we have violas knocking down the door. And it just, I'm so excited by all of the wonderful talent we've been seeing, and we certainly seem to have it at Eastman, too. And I think there are a lot of people who now really, really play the viola at such a high level that I don't think that really pertains any longer.
And it's a heavier instrument.
It is heavier. And I actually had a lot of problems until I realized I needed a smaller instrument, and now I'm fine.
There's different sizes. I don't mean to sound, you know, dumb, but... They're actually physically
different
sizes?
Huge range of differences, and that's one of the main... It's sort of, I think acoustically in the string family, the viola is the disaster of the bunch. There's no perfect solution, because often a smaller instrument won't project as well, whereas a larger instrument won't be as clear. It'll be woofy. I feel very fortunate with this beautiful viola that I was able to find through a colleague in the Boston Symphony 3 years ago that I kind of have the best of both worlds.
It is what?
It is a Vincenzo Panormo from 1791, and I feel very fortunate to have Vinny, as I call him, as my life partner for now.
Can you feel all the fingers that have touched Vinny ahead of you?
You know, this, and people think musicians are crazy anyway, but you do sense with an older instrument, you sense a past with it, and I find it beautiful. I never feel like I'm alone with this viola.
You have a very different life because you get to, Tony, pick up whoever it is
You
happen to meet in the room at the time whenever you sit down at a keyboard.
Exactly. And this is the variety of pianos that I've played is quite extraordinary, some wonderful and some abominable and some somewhere in between. And that is part of the life of a pianist. You have to learn to make the most beautiful music you can on the instrument that's in front of you. To a certain extent, the pianist has more to do with the sound than the instrument does. You have to have a vision of the sound you want and then do what it takes to create that. On the other hand, if you try to exceed what an instrument will give you, you end up sounding kind of brutal and nasty, or if you try to exceed the soft range of an instrument, you fail at that end, too. So
I think that's actually, of course, very true with stringed instruments. If you have a beautiful, warm, big sound, you can play on a cigar box and people will know it's you. And someone, for instance, the people who, there's some very expensive old Italian instruments that I've played on that they weren't for me. You know, so it has nothing to do with the price of the instrument. It has to do with what really vibrates with you. But you will sound like yourself on anything. Don't fool yourself. Just some things help.
You both started very young. You premiered at 17 with Philadelphia, right?
Yes, with the Walton Concerto.
With the Walton, which I noticed your student is lugging around with him these days. So there you go. And you were, what, 10, Tony?
Yeah, same situation.
The Walton Concerto?
No, not the Walton Concerto, but the same orchestra, Philadelphia Orchestra, and the same conductor, William Smith, who was a musical godfather to so many of us young kids in the Philadelphia area.
What did you play?
I played the third movement of the first Beethoven Concerto.
Were you aware at the age of 10 and at the age of 17, respectively, that this was kind of a big thing?
Do you know, I didn't realize how serious it was until my mother left me alone backstage and the overture started. It was Candide, Bernstein's Candide, and I suddenly thought, oh my goodness, what am I doing here? And I was terrified, but then the orchestra started to play the beginning of the Walton and all of that lower string yumminess from the Philadelphia Orchestra. It's still one of the great thrills of my life to have been on stage with that sound.
One of the kindest things anybody ever did or said to me was something that Bill Smith did on my first appearance at the Academy of Music in Philadelphia. He heard me warming up backstage and sensed that I was a little nervous, and he came over and asked me straight out, "Are you nervous?" And I thought, well, I shouldn't lie to this nice man, and I said, "Yes, I'm nervous." And he said, "Well, you should be. This is the Philadelphia Orchestra." And suddenly I wasn't nervous anymore because he gave me permission to feel the way I was feeling. It was the nicest thing he could have done.
And I remember, actually, he said at the time when he was introducing me, "The violas are the philosophers of the orchestra." Oh. And that has stayed with me, because I think it's actually true. As a violist, you don't have you're not looking for a career in the limelight as a violinist or as some pianists and as even cellists these days can do. We don't have the repertoire for it. Our instrument actually doesn't project that well as a soloist with orchestra. And so all the violists I know are thinkers, deep-feeling thinkers who don't necessarily want to be in the spotlight. And they're movers and shakers.
Well, I'm looking forward to another philosophical discussion with the two of you now here on Backstage Pass. Our guests today are Carol Rodlin and Tony Barone, and we're going for something completely different now here on WXXI as they play and we listen to a little Cole Porter and Anything Goes. Thank you. Kenji Bunch's arrangement of Cole Porter's Anything Goes on Backstage Pass. Production of WXXI's Backstage Pass is made possible in part by a grant from the Gouvernet Arts Fund at Rochester Area Community Foundation, encouraging support of the arts. Carol Rodlin, the violist, and pianist Tony Barone join us today. You talked about the advice that you got, the kind advice that you got, and our time is starting to wrap up a little. So I wanted to know, if a pianist comes to you, what is the best piece of advice you could give?
Put your whole heart in it and play music you love.
I expected something longer somehow.
Well, really, why do we play? We play because there's something deep inside of us that can't get out through other media, through words or actions. We need the music to express that thing. And, you know, you spend all those long hours in the practice room perfecting a technique, but the real reason you do it is to be able to share that thing, that kernel that's in you, with people who are willing to listen.
Carol?
To thine own self be true. That you, exactly as Tony said, that you play from your heart, that you remember that you love it, and that ultimately it's about communicating with people with from the deepest part of yourself, hopefully to the deepest part of your listener's self.
When you have a student who is clearly not doing that, how do you turn that around? How do you find that kernel inside your student, Carol?
Maybe Kyle should answer that. No, I really try to help people remember why they're doing what they're doing. And that, yes, it's such a gift to be a musician because you learn discipline, you learn wonderful work habits and all of that, but you also get to do something that you absolutely love. You get to express yourself through your work. And how fortunate are we to have that? And I'm also always grateful that the life of a musician, while we may be vagabonds, we travel a lot and that gets stressful, but we meet so many wonderful people along the way from all over the world, and may sound cheesy, but it brings people closer.
I'm so happy that we got to meet both of you today. Thank you so much for coming in for Backstage Pass.
Thanks so much for having us.
It was a joy.
Our executive producer and director is Gene Fisher. Our technical producer is Dave Slaberski, with assistance from Nick Bennett. Our page turner is Kyle Miller. I'm your producer and host, Julia Figueres. Thanks so much to Carol Rodlin and Marc Antonio Barone. Carol will play us out today on Backstage Pass with I Got Rhythm on WXXI FM. Thank you.